Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. I am Reggie Darden, and I am overjoyed and kind of speechless, which is not good for a podcast, but I am overjoyed to have Lee Wedlake with me today, and we're going to chat some Kenpo and whatever else we happen to come across. I'm just, you know, starstruck and fanboying, fangirling, and... yeah, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna start right off with the butt kissing and the truth telling. I when you agreed to be on, I said that I was going to finish lessons with Ed Parker before. Unfortunately, I have not. I'm still about 20 pages. I think I need to get through to finish it, but I'm just really, really, really love with the book Lessons with Ed Parker. There's a new 2024 edition, so for those that maybe already have the book but didn't know that it was a little update to that, definitely get it. I'm just really loving, one of the things that I really love about the book is just that, you know, you do really get a sense of what it was like to be, you know, around Ed Parker and what kind of person he was versus just, oh, well, here are the facts about, you know, he lived here and he did this and he did that. And it's like, you know, you kind of get a little insight into, you know, what his personality was, what kind of things he was thinking about and how he, you know, carried himself. And so,
well, I'm glad that you said that, because that was my aim with writing the book. And I've had several people tell me that they said, yeah, you got that. You did that for us. And one of my black belts who had been there back in the 80s in Chicago, when Mr. Parker used to come in regularly, said, yeah, I remember all that. And they said it brought back a lot of great memories. So, and that's exactly what I wanted to do with it, was to get people like you a sense of, like, this is what he was like as a man, not just his technical stuff. Of course, you know, that's in the book as well. But, you know, those things like, what was his dog's name and what kind of car did he drive?
Yeah, sort of thing.
It was always funny to see Ed Parker get out of a little old Volkswagen.
Yeah, I'm sure that was quite a sight. So to kind of get us going here, so just to kind of give the brief history on my background. So I started in the mid-90s, early mid-90s, after seeing The Perfect Weapon. Like many other folks, I saw all those great moves, and I said, I got to do that. And so I started at a school that was you know, we called it a Chinese Kenpo school, but the curriculum was essentially a Tracy's Kenpo school. Did that, and for a few years, got about halfway to my third brown, and I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to dabble a little bit in some Taekwondo, some Hapkido, and some boxing, and did that until I got out. Once I got out, I wanted to get back into a Kenpo, but I just didn't find a school that I liked at the time. So I just kind of did my own thing, and, you know, didn't want to kind of get back into Taekwondo or any other kind of arts. But then I stumbled across a Capoeira teacher and started doing Capoeira. And as of this recording, I'm closing in on 17 years of doing Capoeira. So, you know, just really enjoying that, and you know, still kind of did you know, worked on my Kenpo stuff a little bit here and there that I could remember. Then a few years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, came across my old training manual, and I was like, ooh, like how many things can I remember? And I kind of tried to, you know, go back through that, and that reignited my love for Kenpo, and I decided, you know, hey, I gotta get back into this for reals. And so I started you know, looking for a school, and found the school that I'm training at now, and it's an American Kenpo school, and just really enjoying that. The time of this recording, I'm about a month out from getting I tested and got my green about a month ago, and just, you know, really enjoying the journey and the training, and now with this podcast, just getting to talk with just all sorts of Kenpo folk, both the OG, usual suspects, and lesser known folk. I just really love hearing the stories and learning the different perspectives, and just kind of taking it all in. So I'm glad to have the show here, and I want to talk to as many Kenpo people as I can. So everybody check your inboxes, and probably.
How'd you like the boxing?
It was great training. I mean, I didn't do, I didn't do any fights or anything. I was just there for the training, but I really loved it in that, the second you walk in the door, that first minute that the class starts to the very last minute when class is over, you're working. There's no stopping. It's
good stuff. Ed Parker's father was the boxing commissioner in Hawaii. I'm sure you read that in my book. Mm-hmm. And before they had a rating system like they do today, where somebody could be rated and say, this is where we're going to place him. Ed Parker's dad used to get in the ring with these guys and fight them. And that's how they were rated. So Mr. Parker learned how to box. And when I got to Pasadena, Frank Trejo was the manager at the studio there. And Frank had been a boxer as well as doing Muay Thai. Oh. And he would eventually come up with something that he called Kenpo Fusion. Well, I introduced Frank to one of my black belts, who is a Golden Gloves winner and a fifth degree in Kenpo. And he's also a black belt in Muay Thai under Francisco Conde, who Sean Kelly studied with. And he had met Ed Parker because Conde was a good friend of Ed Parker's. And that's how, there was Ed Parker, Francisco Conde, and Joe Palanzo thing over there in the Baltimore area, Pennsylvania area. So Eddie Cabrera is his name. He's a Muay Thai black belt under Conde. And he and Frank hit it off. So Frank says, yeah, you can use the Kenpo Fusion thing because Eddie's got an integration of Western boxing with the Parker techniques, which is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that, learning how to do Western boxing is pretty important because we've got some techniques in Kenpo that you can see that they are based on. Hmm. Are very, very similar to Western boxing technique. Five swords is one of them. It's like a right-handed version of a jab, cross, and an uppercut sort of thing. But the contact part of boxing, that's one thing that they've got that a lot of Kenpo people don't do, is they don't have that kind of contact.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got to be real careful with that because your brain gets scrambled.
Yeah.
But maybe you'd want to talk to Eddie Cabrera sometime for your podcast because he's a real interesting guy.
Yeah, one of the things that I really loved about boxing, and I still even apply that or try and implement that today, not only with the Kenpo but with the Capoeira as well, is the footwork.
And Eddie's really good at that. Eddie's got some really slick footwork. I saw him teach a seminar at Glenn Haley's school when he had it in Austin, Texas, where I used to live. Mm-hmm. And Eddie did some stuff, and I was like, what? What did you just do? He's got some really cool stuff. So you'd want to talk to him sometime. And the capoeira was a pretty cool thing, too. I'd seen that at the Internationals many years ago, and I'd seen it done on the street in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. But that's a real athletic sort of thing. And anybody who's not familiar with it should go and do some reading about how it developed.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Why are you fighting on your hands?
Yeah, there's, I think capoeira gets kind of gets, well, I think maybe kind of all martial arts get this, is that you only, you know, when you see, you know, you kind of get that surface level exposure to it. And then you kind of, it's like, oh, well, this thing isn't going to work and that thing isn't going to work. And it's like, well, that's not, you know, that's not the whole art. And it's like, until you get the deeper knowledge of it, then you start understanding, oh, well, there's, you know, things that we show that we don't, you know, wouldn't actually use or do, you know. I mean, you know, I'm not going to do a backflip in training, but not going to do a backflip in a fight either. But there's a lot more to it than I think a lot of people see. But, you know, definitely going to get more of that out there as a, you know, kind of, a, you know, I'm going to be doing kind of a soft launch on through this show, but I'm going to essentially be doing the same show for the Capoeira side of things here and talking about the Capoeira.
Ed Parkerhead was lining up the demos for the internationals one year. So I was at his house and we were talking about it. He said he was going to have a Capoeira person or a team do something. And I said, why are we doing that? Because, you know, the Kempo tournament should be Kempo demos, blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me and he said, I want you to see it, because if you're ever faced with it on the street, at least you got an idea what's coming and you can handle it. Yep. I went, there you go. So if you understand that about Ed Parker, it's like, why do we do some of the things we do? It's because he wanted you to see this stuff so that you could spontaneously apply your Kempo.
Exactly. You got to be prepared for anything. So
yeah,
that's huge. So, so let's jump to your story. How did Kempo find you, and you know, where did it all start for you? And
well, I've been doing martial arts since 1955. I started in 67 in judo, and I was at the YMCA. I did some judo, I did some boxing, and my mother put me in a real judo school on the south side of Chicago. Hmm. And so I did that up to the rank of brown belt. And I did it when I was up into college. And I ran into some Kempo guys at a party. And they said, oh, you do martial arts? I do martial arts and all that. And then they said, come on down to the studio. So I went to visit their school. I said, I like this. And at that time, there wasn't a judo school near me. We had moved out away from that area, so I didn't have a place to go do that, but the Kempo school was close, so I started doing that. And that was a Tracy's type of Kempo, and then I left there, and the reason why is a long story, because the instructor was, if you read my book, The Kempo Companion, I don't like to mention names, but I call this one guy Bad Instructor Number Two.
Hmm.
So I left Bad Instructor Number Two, and I found Michael John Sanders, who was a Kempo black belt and a Kaja Kempo black belt and a Judo black belt and Aikido black belt and Taekwondo black belt and blah, 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 all with legit certification. And I trained with him, and he got himself killed in a motorcycle accident. So I was with him for just a couple of years, and then I had been seeing Ed Parker when I was out on the national tournament circuit. And I attracted his attention, I guess, and he said he wanted to talk to me. So he said, when can you come out to Pasadena? I said, you tell me and I'm there. So I started commuting from Chicago to Southern California to train. And I was just so blessed to have him as a teacher. And that's where I met Frank Trejo. And through him, I met Gil Hibben and Joe Palanzo, Tom Kelly, Huck Plantis, Dave Hebler, Mike Pick. And I actually gave Skip Hancock his first lesson at the Pasadena school.
Oh, wow.
He was already a black belt, but he came down there, and I was the one that introduced him to Ed Parker and brought him over to the house. So I was really fortunate to get directly with the grandmaster, you know, the founder of the system. Mm-hmm. And know, he took a liking to me, and I started, you know, I was always a journalist. I had done it in high school with the high school newspaper and all that. So I started to write, and everything I wrote, I gave to him. He looked at it and said, yeah, that's good. No, that's missing some pieces or something. He gave me a lot of guidance with that. And that led to the magazine articles that I started getting published back in the 80s, which led to the books and brings me to today with people like yourself who've gotten the books and read them and said, huh, there might be something here. So I've published a lot of books on Kempo. I think I'm up to about 12 now.
Yeah, very nice. To kind of go back to, you know, when you started judo. So I'm curious about, you know, now, you know, we have, you know, the internet, we have the UFC, and we have all these things that, you know, expose us to the arts. So going back to when you got involved in judo, was there, like, how do you get exposed to, how did you get exposed to that? And
well, my mom put me in a judo class at the YMCA. And then she put me in a real judo school, Kodokan Judo School.
Right. I should say, what was the motivation for that? Was, you know?
Oh, because my mother made me do it. I, you know, I did not enjoy my first judo classes. She thought I did, so she put me in its other judo school. And when I got there, the instructor was a lady named Carol. And her memory was burned into my brain because she said, you know, I was like 10 years old or something. And she said, so show me what you learned. And I did a couple of break falls. And she says, not like that. And she corrected me. And I said, oh, this is fun. So I went almost every day. I used to walk there from school and then walk home after class. Classes were a couple hours long. I would go on Saturday. I don't know if you can see it, but you see that skull on the wall?
Yes.
And right below it, there's a little case. Well, that's her belt in that case.
Oh.
She gave me that many years ago when we reconnected. And she said, my kids won't appreciate this, and I know you will. So she passed me her belt. And if it wasn't for Carol and my mom, two women, they are really the ones that got me involved in the martial arts. So, you know, getting there with Carol and then, you know, training with the owner of the studio's son was about my age. We got along great, and he became a fourth degree in judo later on. But it was a good physical art, and it has to work. You know, you can't tell somebody in judo, well, if I do this, you're gonna go like this, like you do in Kempo. It's not a striking art, so you have to make it work. And being a judo person like Ed Parker was, we had that in common, so we got to talk. I said, how come we don't have throws in the system? And he said, I don't like having my hands tied up. He just didn't like having both hands tied up to try to do a throw. So the funny part of that is that Mills Crenshaw, who was an Ed Parker black belt in Utah, one of the first ones, Mills Crenshaw watched Mike Sanders, my second Kempo instructor, integrating judo into the Kempo techniques. And he said, that's all very well and nice. He says, but you got to understand that the Japanese are a very industrious people, and they will pick somebody up to throw him down, whereas we just hit him enough times he falls down by himself. So
it's very effective.
Yeah, but we're working on a program that we call KST, which is Kempo Street Throws, because we have a lot of people that are interested in that sort of thing. And, you know, earlier you asked me, like, well, you know, how do I see the system? Where is it going to go? And, you know, well, it's a system. Just like a computer has an operating system, or an engine is a system. And then you have apps, or you have gizmos that you tack onto that system. So in my lineage, we will have this Street Throws app. We've got a joint locking app. We've got a boxing app. And it's to integrate using the Parker thinking. And based on the Parker techniques, it's like, how does this stuff fit in there? So you don't have to stop and think about what you're doing. It's not like I got to switch over to this other method of motion that's all just blends together. It's working very well. It's still in a development process, but people seem to like it and what they've seen.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really love about Kenpo is that it makes a good base for connecting in with other systems, other methodologies and such. I've brought it up on a few with a few of the other guests that I've spoke with, but I was a big fan of the Panther production videos.
Oh yeah,
back in the days, and one of the ones that really stood out to me was David German's Kenpo Jiu-Jitsu connection, and combining the Jiu-Jitsu wrist locks and arm bars and such. With the Kenpo, and it just fit so well, and I really, really always enjoyed that. One that really stuck out to me was him adding wrist locks and arm bars to flashing wings, and just remember just kind of watching that and just like, oh, like this is so cool, and like having that ability to just connect in.
Well, it's all built in. I mean, if you learn the standard Parker techniques and you see that there's stand-up jiu-jitsu in it, and there's a lot of different types of wrist locks, arm locks, shoulder locks, leg locks, and all that. So the idea is to learn how to do the locks properly, and then you learn how to transition from one to the other, and you're always in a margin for error position, so you can go to just punching the snot out of them,
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
So going back to the early days, so when you got involved with Kenpo, was that kind of, was it, instantly love at first sight, or did it take a little bit for you to kind of?
No, it was love at first sight. I mean, I saw it the first day and I said, I really like that. Mm-hmm. That looks great. And then when I started to do it, I just couldn't get enough of it. You know the feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a middle knuckle strike for the first time, and I saw it coming and hit me in the solar plexus. Because it's like, what's that?
So, was there any difficulty in making the adjustment from judo to kenpo? So, like with me, I mean, I'm actually still kind of battling with this. So, coming from the Tracy version to what I'm currently doing, there's still, I guess you could say, kind of muscle memory, or there's a little bit of a disconnect, and also the same with, doing capoeira. There are things that you do in capoeira that are completely opposite from Kenpo. So,
yeah, that's the thing that I've told people for years is that, again, Parker used to say that Kenpo is a language of motion. And when you speak a language and you learn another language, typically you're going to have an accent. So there's a term called code switching. And code switching usually refers to when somebody speaks a language and they can go from English to Spanish and back again, and they have little or no hesitation. Ingmar Johansson in Sweden speaks Spanish, English, and Swedish. And I was with him one night where I was teaching in Stockholm, and he was talking to a group of us. He spoke to me in English, this guy in Swedish, and that guy in Spanish, and he flawlessly was doing code switching. So when somebody does Tung Sudo or some other type of system where the footwork is different, the stances are different, some people, like myself, are called body mimics, and it's like we can switch quickly. Other people have one heck of a time. And you, I believe, if you're going to go cross-train, first you need to talk to your teacher, because your teacher should be able to tell you, it's like, that may not be good for you because of blah, blah, blah. And they may say, yeah, that's going to be great because that doesn't have much conflict in method of motion. So you need to get that guidance before you just go off and do it, because otherwise I've seen people fight with themselves trying to, like, oh no, my foot's got to be turned in instead of turned forward. And and you know, you don't do this, and you know, checking. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's one of my kryptonites there.
Yeah. And with the Tracy system, at least like the way I learned the Tracy system, the checks were missing and there were some methods of motion that were like, and it took quite some time to work that out. But part of it was because my first Kempo instructor was a really bad instructor.
Hmm.
And, you know, if somebody said, well, why do you do this? He's like, he didn't know. He didn't know. So he couldn't tell you. And that was one of the things when I was an 18-year-old kid, I'm going, somebody's got to know. Somebody has to know. I need to find this person. I was able to find them.
Hmm.
All the way up to Ed Parker himself. So that stuff works itself out. But if you, man, if you were doing it every day and ingraining that stuff and you go years later, that habit is still there. Hmm. So you've got to slow down. You got to be mindful. You need to be diligent. You need somebody either watching you or you videotape yourself and you go, my hips aren't straight. My shoulders aren't level. My sticking my chin out or, you know, my got my pinky sticking out or something. You got to self-correct.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, it'll work out usually.
Hmm.
There's hope.
Yeah, no, I've changed my focus over the time that I've been training and you know, yeah, I'm seeing the progression. But yeah, definitely having my struggles with some, you know, like I said, the checking so many times it's like you did the technique great, but you know, where were the checks? And
yeah. Well, you know, the thing too is like what I found out with the Parker system is that he said, well, we got principles, you know, we have these guiding rules that we use. And if you understand those, you can be self-correcting. Well, see, the thing when I learned the Tracy system, he said, why do we do this? Or, you know, he was like, he just didn't know. So there was no guidance. It's like we didn't know, like, if you strike high, you check low and vice versa. We had no idea. Terminology? No. It's not even close. So, you know, at least if you've got the principles, and you, my son, are much luckier because there's books you can buy and there's YouTube and all that, and you can read things. You can read the Ed Parker books, and you'll have to read them a couple of times because they get a little confusing. And, I mean, I read volume 3 times before I said, oh, that's what he means. I know what he's talking about. But the first time I was like, oh. And I was there when he wrote it. I mean, I wrote the foreword to the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you have those resources that we didn't have way back when. And then you can engage your BS detector and watch some of these videos and read some of this material and go, I don't think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a resource. You get somebody who knows. And you're like, if you got a question, you send me an email or something like that, and I'll promptly ignore it, and you go on your way. But no, I mean, I get questions from people because they go, I don't know. I said, well, I think I can help you.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something that's, you know, great about, you know, living in this information age is that, you know, we have these, you know, ways to reach out to people that know, and, you know, get the information from the sources. And
well, you know, and that's what you just said is really important, because I've met a lot of people that they just they go off on their own and they promote themselves and so on. And it's like the resources are out there. I mean, there's still seniors. We're losing them, but there's still seniors out there that you can ask, and there's books that you can read. And there's training that you can get, but, you know, it's the path of least resistance sort of thing. So it's always more comfortable to just keep doing what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
than it is to start going out of the limb. And that's what, you know, Mr. Parker and I talked about that. He said, you know what I like about you? He says, you're willing to go backwards to go forwards. Because I had to relearn the system. I relearned it 3 times. It's like, I understand. I know where you're at. You know, I've been there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. So yeah, you have to take it all in. And you know, it's really unfortunate that there is so much, fighting and, clout chasing and stuff, when we should be about promoting the art.
Yeah, you know, that's a human thing, and that's gone on forever. It's gone on forever. So, people that weren't around in the 70s and all that go, well, you know, they're all of a sudden there's these new associations. So they were doing it back then. It's, you know, this is not new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, having, spent so much time with Ed Parker and, kind of what is your view as far as maybe the direction that Kempo is going now, and where would you like to maybe see it going, or
well, the system is, it's still expanding, and it expanded quickly in the United States, and that was not because of Mr. Parker, that was because of the Tracy brothers. They were really the ones that took it on the road. And then it went overseas. And Ed Parker actually told Chuck Sullivan once, Chuck Sullivan told me this. He said, system got away from me. And it was really hard. And it's still hard. It's like, it's almost impossible to standardize. Mm-hmm. And so what I realized years and years ago is like, well, all you can do is keep your own house clean. So if I have my lineage, it's like I can work on my guys and get them to do my thing, because everybody at every lineage is going to tell you, well, that's how Ed Parker wanted it. That's what everybody says. It's like, but you see some of these guys who say that and do that, and you look at what they do and you go, no, that will get you hurt. So I've spent so much of my adult life out on the mat teaching across the United States and overseas, and sometimes I would wonder, like, am I wasting my time? But when I see people coming up to do such a great job, it's like, okay, so the system's expanding. It does need some quality control, but a lot of that is just, it's beyond us. Because when I'm seeing fifth, sixth, seventh degree black belts that can't do an attention stance, it's like, that tells me like it hasn't gotten all the way down to your fingers and toes, and either you don't know or you don't care. So you got to clean it up. So I would like to see that sort of thing happening. But I would also like to see, there's got to be a research and development phase to this. So you've got your basic system, and the Parker techniques are a system, just like a car engine is. People don't understand the system. You know, he talked about being a mechanic and an engineer and a magician of motion and all that. But somebody can take an engine apart, they put it back together, and they got a couple of bolts left. It's like, okay, sometimes it'll run and sometimes it won't. And then that bolt goes into a coffee can. So now they've got a series of techniques, and somebody didn't like this one technique because they didn't understand it. So that bolt goes in a coffee can. And the system's not complete anymore. I can't tell you how many times I've run into people who said, well, my teacher didn't like that, so he didn't teach it to us. And I show it to them, and they go, oh, that makes perfect sense. So now they can put the bolt back in. So the system runs right. And, you know, so you've got a system, and then you've got the style, which is how Reggie does it, which is versus how Steve does it, how this person does it. And so it's the application. But you need to have a real solid grounding on what he was trying to get across with that before you start messing with it, taking pieces out and all that. You know, he laid us all out. Like you said, he was a college student when he started developing this. A very smart college student. And he talked to a lot of very educated people, a lot of experienced people when he started to develop this, and he put his thing together. And he came up with what we have today. It's a work of genius. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, no, he's definitely, ahead of his time, definitely a visionary thinker. And, it's to be able to kind of, you know, pick apart these things and really, you know, come up with these principles. And
Well, you know, he was the first one to be acknowledged here in the United States as creating a dictionary of martial arts terminology. So nobody had done that before, because, you know, typically you have Asian, you know, Chinese, Japanese terminology being used to describe things, and then you have Americans trying to spit these things out in a studio, and then you find out it's like, well, they're mispronouncing it, or they don't have the right interpretation or translation of that. So he said, "We speak English, let's use that." And so he wanted to make it so that it was useful for us. You know, we don't fight in rice paddies, and we don't fish for a living, typically on a small boat. We wear shoes and all that. So he had to modify that art. So as he put it together, said, "Let's get you a complete package," and he did a pretty good job.
Yeah, very, very much so, very much so. So to kind of change gears here, so I'm curious if there are, I mean, you know, over your career, there's obviously been exposed to a lot of things, but curious if there is a you know, time or two that kind of sticks out in your memory, preferably before you were a black belt, that, you know, maybe a fun or humorous point in your training that maybe you might want to share with us that kind of comes to mind.
Well, you know, we were cocky Kempo guys in Chicago in the early 70s, wearing black uniforms, and people didn't do that back then. And we were going to a tournament, you know, the coming weekend, and it was, I had called ahead and I said, "The flyer says it's an open tournament." "Yes, it is." "That means it's open rules." "Yes, it is." "Okay, so we're going up there." We get there and it's a taekwondo tournament. It's taekwondo rules. No grabbing, sweeping, groin kicking, head punching, stomping, none of that. So they said, "We will give you trophies to go home." So we said, "No." So we went out and we competed anyway, and I think all of us got disqualified, but that was fun.
Yeah, I went to a lot of tournaments as, you know, a spectator. I competed in about a handful of them, and you know, like many Kempo folks, I think I got disqualified in every sparring, you know, match I was in. Just it's a different, very different beast. But yeah, we had the first school that I trained at, we had, I don't know if it was a real thing or maybe just projecting something from the movie, but I always kind of had this belief that there was some sort of kind of rivalry between Kempo and Taekwondo people. And had these Taekwondo guys come into our school, and you know, they came to our sparring class, and I guess they were thinking they were going to kind of mop the floor with us, because, you know, Kempo folks are not particularly known for kicking. But my first instructor, he did have quite a bit of training in Taekwondo, so we did work kicking quite a bit. And those Taekwondo.
Yeah, you know, there always was a rivalry, and it goes way back. And I remember somebody in Chicago, somebody was calling around looking for schools to go to, and they told me that they had called a Taekwondo school and said, "Well, should I take Taekwondo or should I take Kempo?" And he said, "You want to learn how to fight, you do Taekwondo. You want to learn how to dance, you take Kempo." Like, well, okay. So that was the attitude. But when I was in college, I was a brown belt, and one of the teaching assistants saw that I had a jacket with a Parker patch on it. And so we got to talking. He says, hey, well, let's go, you know, let's go up to the student union. We'll work out. And he says, I've been out for a long time, so I'm pretty rusty. So we get, you know, we pick a day and a time. We meet up there and we put the gear on and all that. And so we bow. And he had told me, you know, he was a black belt, that he hadn't done it in a long time. And he was rusty. He was a Taekwondo guy. So I put my guard up and he kicks me in the head. I said, okay. So I kick him in the groin. I grab him. I sweep his feet out from under him. I punch him in the head and I stomped him. And so he stood up and he looked at me and he laughed and he bowed. And then we played nice. So I just knew I had to do everything to him that they don't allow in what they do. But that leveled the playing field. And he was pretty good. And he was a great guy. Abdi Ben Levi, black guy from the south side of Chicago.
Very nice. Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, it's you know, it's been a fun road to, you know, learn kind of, you know, be exposed to the other arts and kind of see how they're, you know, how they're different, and I get some, you know, in the mindset of, oh, like, you know, this is how everybody does it. And then you go to another school or you're training with somebody in another art, and it's like, oh, wait a second. Yeah, this is very, very different than what they're doing.
Well, you know, the whole martial art thing is like you treat everybody with respect. And it's when you start preconceiving, you go, well, Taekwondo guys can't punch. Well, I've met some Taekwondo guys that can hit real hard and real good with their hands. Mm-hmm. And it's called the foot fist way for a reason. So I've seen, like, you know who Larry Lamb is?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Larry Lamb did a seminar at my studio in Florida many years ago. And I watched him work. I was like, that guy uses his leg like an arm. Well, I was pretty impressed. He was one of the best Taekwondo. Well, he came out of Ernie Reyes' school in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it shouldn't have surprised me, but there's some of them out there. So it's like, it's not the system necessarily, it's the person. So you treat everybody with respect because you will get yourself into trouble if you're looking down your nose like that guy did with me when I was in college. And so, we're all in this together. We're climbing the mountain from different sides. So be nice to one another.
Exactly.
Even
exactly.
Though my system's better.
There we go. That's what I was looking for. Very nice. Very nice. Oh my goodness. Let's kind of, hit our, lightning round here as we, Closing on our time here. So, you've heard these already. Since for those that don't know, we had a little scheduling conflict with my other guest, but we'll just go through it again because, you know, I don't see how I'm not sure how I'm gonna edit all this stuff around, but we'll figure it out. But so do you have a favorite technique?
I've been asked that question before. My answer is always, it's the one that makes them fall down and leave me alone.
I like it. That's the perfect answer for that. Very nice. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
I really like form six. I won a lot of tournaments with four, but I really like six. Because six is the form that is the closest to Tai Chi with what we do. Not because it's slow, but because when your hands start moving, they don't stop moving. Mm-hmm. There are no halts in the form at all. It's got a lot of great concepts in it, and it's a good cardio workout now. So I really like six.
Okay. Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, I've been kind of... I feel like maybe I'm starting to, I guess it just kind of depends on who I interviewed. I kind of figured that, you know, most people were going to say like four, but I think in the last few ones I've done, more people have mentioned sex. So
now the most important one is short one.
Yeah,
that's your foundation right there. Exactly. And short two is actually a difficult form if you think about it. But anyway,
yeah.
Next question.
No, I agree. So if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
I was asked that question recently also, and my answer was then and is now Jigoro Kano, the founder of Judo.
Oh, very nice.
That guy was a genius too, and there's a lot to him if you read his life story, and very innovative. He was actually on the International Olympic Committee way back when, early 1900s. And so he was a huge influence, and people think about judo and they go, "Oh, you know, judo." Well, you know, if you read the old texts, there's stuff in there about ground fighting, and like, you got it. He says you don't want to be on the ground because there might be multiple attackers, and they might be armed. He knew that, and judo teaches striking and defenses against knives and guns and all. So it's like, yeah, I would like to sit and talk with him.
Very nice. I like it. I like it. So the final question, since in honor of Mr. Parker's love for jokes and humor, do you have a joke or, you know, I need to start kind of reworking this question, but do you have a joke or humorous story that you'd like to share?
Yeah, he was a funny guy. And when I would take him to and from the airports, we would spend the time in the car telling jokes. And some of them, like what your last guest Joe says, I can't repeat that because, you know, he was not opposed to telling that, or rather off-color joke now and then. But there was one thing he did that was funny. He would come up to somebody and he'd go, "That's a really nice shirt. Do they make that in men's?"
Oh, goodness.
He was a funny guy and he'd tease you.
I like it.
So yeah,
you know, I think we need a little bit more of that. You know, today we have kind of all the, you know, the wokeness and whatnot, and
I know I'm offended.
We're not going to get into that, but actually that made me think about this, and I actually meant to ask you about that earlier, but. So, you know, with the, you know, the advent of the MMA and just kind of the way society has changed and you know, what do you see maybe like a difference in the attitude as far as, you know, students that you know come to train with you? Is, you know, we've gotten away from kind of the, you know, the Karate Kid way of, you know, the respect and the, you know, humbleness and the grit.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of more about the, you know, the showboating or.
Well, I tell you, Reggie, I like to blame this on Burger King. Because several decades ago, they started an advertising campaign, which is "Have It Your Way."
Oh, yeah.
So everybody's like, "Have it your way. Everybody's a winner. Everybody gets a trophy." And it's like, no, fact of life is that there's winners and losers. It's just the way it is. And you got to deal with that. So I blame a lot of this, not only on society, but, you know, the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And society as a whole, I remember back in the late 60s, there was a pretty pronounced shift in what was going on out there on the street. And it's gotten worse, where like the value of human life is like really a lot less than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just for an example, it used to be if you got mugged on the street in downtown Chicago, the guy would say, "Give me your wallet, lay down on the ground and just don't do anything until I go away." And then he'd take your wallet and run. Well, then they would do the same thing, but then they would shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, you know, that's kind of a guarantee. They're not going to say anything. So and it's gotten worse. I mean, I know that we've seen the news. It's like, what's going on out there? It's like, so you need self-defense. You got to have it. Protect yourself and your family.
Exactly. Yeah, no, yeah, it's just kind of really crazy how things have changed and just the attitude and really kind of the viciousness of how kind of people are now is really, really surprising to me.
Well, you know, read the old martial art classics. And I'm sure you're familiar with them. And they tell you to be respectful to people. And they'll tell you, it's like, don't hurt them if you don't have to. But if you got to hurt them, and then you got to, there's a force progression, just like they taught us in law enforcement. They have the same thing in the martial arts. It's like, don't go from 0 to 60. Okay. Restrain them if you have to. Maybe break something if you have to. Really break something if you have to and maim him. Or if you have to, maybe you may have to kill him. But that's an extreme, very extreme. And so you just need to be nice to people. You know, try to walk away and all that. I mean, it's hard. It's so hard. Somebody gets in your face and starts calling you names and all that. It's like, I've had people threaten my life. I've been called a racist. I've been called a communist and a Nazi, all in the law enforcement sort of thing. I mean, I've been there. And all you can do is just go, well, okay.
That's when the good old advice of one Dalton from Roadhouse comes in. You know, be nice. You know, someone gets in your face, be nice, and you know they call you something. You know, well, they're just words used to elicit a specific response. So.
They can say whatever they want as long as they're walking away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. So, is it time for a shameless plug?
Yes. Whatever you want to bring up, mention that we haven't covered that you'd like to share with us.
Okay. So Lessons with Ed Parker was just re-released recently. That is available on Amazon, and so is the Kempo Karate Compendium, which I released in 2015. That was a combination of my 101 through 601 books. So those are out of print, but they were put together into that. And then I put out the Kempo Companion a couple of years ago, which has got things in it like a little bit about combat psychology, and there's a curriculum for a women's self-defense program in there. There's a breakdown on how to analyze techniques and what the freestyle techniques do and blah, blah, blah. And it's a pretty big book. It's about 500 some odd pages. I'm rewriting Further Insights into Kempo. So that's been expanded, and that was published in 2001. So that should be coming at you probably within the next 6 months. I've written three fiction books with Phil Buck in England. So if you like absurd fiction, you may want to pick those up. They're called Whisper from the Alamo, Runaway Blues, and Living Life on Maui. I have a Vimeo platform. With by subscription, there's almost 2,000 videos on Kempo and how to do the terminology and the techniques and the forms and the freestyles. You know, like the system is up there. Excellent. So get a hold of that. I've got a couple of Facebook pages or Wastebook if you prefer that. So I'm easy to find, and I'm out there on the seminar circuit quite a bit. So I've got the books, the videos, the actual teaching, and I do online lessons too. Which keeps me busy, as along with the other stuff I do as an old retired guy.
No, gotta stay busy. Gotta stay busy. So
that's, yeah, if you rest, you rust.
Exactly. Well, yeah, no, I thank you so much for taking the time to chit chat with me, and you know, I love hearing your story, and I love, you know, I love your book, and I will certainly get to the other ones and just continue to follow what you got going on. So
yeah, well, I'm glad to see you're doing this podcast series, because I saw you on Facebook and saying you were thinking about it, and then you said you were going to do it.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, just keep at it. That's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I have to throw my brother under the bus because, you know, he's talked about doing a podcast for like years. And I pretty much, when I kind of committed to the idea to actually starting it, it was really, I guess about half a week between the committed idea and, the first recording. So you just got to go out and do it. But, it's a lot of work, but I'm really enjoying it. I really like the stories and just learning so much and just getting exposed to people that, I may not have otherwise if I didn't.
You're part of that next generation. Some of us aren't going to be around much longer.
That's the other part of it too, getting some of these, getting some of these stories directly from the source, before those resources are gone. Yeah. So, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And, we will talk soon.
All right, Reggie. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Mm-hmm, bye.